Please be seated.
Thank you.
The next case on the court's calendar is Tahiti Village Masters Homeowners Association Petitioner versus 8th Judicial District Court, and real party in interest is M&H Enterprises, Inc., Nevada Corporation, DBA Martin Harris Construction et al., case number 64803. Mr. Wall, Mr. Flansburg, good to see you both. You ready to go? All right, Mr. Wall.
Chief Justice Hardy C. and Associate Justices, I thank you on behalf of my client for the opportunity to be here. My name is Michael Wall. For the record, I represent Tahiti Village Master Owners Association. The issue today is really quite simple. The court needs to interpret the statute, in our opinion, according to the plain language of the statute. It was interesting that the main argument in the opposition brief to our argument was that this court should interpret the statute according to the plain language of the statute, but the respondent didn't want to address the statute, only putting it in on page 17, hardly even addressing it, and then trying to change or not address the language of the statute. What counsel would like, or what opposing counsel would like this court to do, is to interpret the plain language of the statute to be what they wish the statute said, not what the statute says. There's really only one statute that needs to be construed here, and that's NRS 40.630, which says, residence means any dwelling in which title to the individual units is transferred to the owners. It couldn't be more clear. Throughout the brief, throughout opposing counsel's brief, every time they use the word home and homeowners, regardless of whether they're quoting it or from what source it comes from, they always bold it so that they, homeowner is the issue. But the statute doesn't use the word homeowner. The statute talks in terms of residences. And the statute talks in terms of claimants. And the statute defines that term. Residence is a defined term. And it has the term, the definition that's given. And there are three important parts to that definition that I just read. Any dwelling, individual units, not homes, and transfer of title. Those are the three things that are necessary.
So, Mr. Wall, all these timeshare claimants, though, did receive a deed to their interest in the timeshare. It's not a right to use leasehold interest. Is that correct?
The timeshare interest is actually they purchased the unit that they own. They purchased a particular unit, an identified unit, and they own that unit. Typically, in the timeshare situation, you purchase that unit for your week, and if you use it in your week, you use your unit. But if you don't use it during that week, then, of course, you have contractual arrangements with those who are managing the operation, the owners association.
But they have a deed giving them fee simple title to the particular week that they own in that unit. Is that correct?
They own it in fee title. That's exactly right, Your Honor. In fact, they get a grant bargain and sale deed, and that grant bargain and sale deed identifies that one particular unit and transfers that unit to them, and it says the property is yours forever in fee simple. Now, that's important that the property is transferred in fee simple, but if you go back to the statute, it just says an individual unit is transferred to the owner. It doesn't say what type of title has to be transferred to the owner. The point is ownership, not the type of title, and it's not the characteristics of that title. Throughout the argument of the opposing counsel, both here and below, the argument continues to be, well, you don't get to use it when you might get a different unit if you're coming at a different time. You have to register for it, and you have all of these restrictions. But the statute is silent with respect to restrictions. It doesn't talk about that at all. In fact, it couldn't be broader. It says any unit. Any unit is what a statute. Any dwelling is how the statute defines a residence. Opposing counsel has cited multiple cases regarding residency, and residency arguments and how, and that there has to be a duration of time in order for you to be living in the premises. There's nothing in the statute that says there has to be a duration of time. The legislature could have easily just stated a time period, a residency period. Cases that are cited from other jurisdictions in this jurisdiction that deal with residency periods don't have anything to do with this case, because a resident is a person who lives in a residence. A residence is a building, and residency is a duration of time. For example, if you want to vote in a particular location, or if you want to be able to have standing to have a divorce, or for whatever other reason, there might be a residency period. There's no residency period in Chapter 40. Instead, the statute defines the building. The important point that was being made by the legislature, the distinction that the legislature drew, is between commercial buildings and residences. That's the main distinction.
And on that point, I'd like to pause you for just a moment. I know you want to just read 40.630, but 40.610 defines claimant, and you alluded to that. What type of claimant is your client?
Our client is an owner's association, which is specifically
recognized. How do you qualify under NRS 40.610?
We come specifically under 40.610 as an owner's association, okay, which was not the issue that they raised below, but has been raised. 6.10 says a claimant is an owner or an association that represents the owner.
But it has to be pursuant to Chapter 116, and I understand your declarations say the groups formed under 116. But on the commercial versus residential piece, Chapter 116 says that timeshares are not, this chapter does not apply to subparagraph E, except as provided in this chapter, timeshares governed by Chapter 119A of the NRS. And then there's an exception that lets a timeshare, it doesn't prohibit a master association which governs a timeshare plan created pursuant to Chapter 119A from providing for a representative form of government for the timeshare plan. But I'm not sure that's broad enough to bring you in under 610.2. And that's 40.610.2. That's my question, because I think there is a distinction generally between timeshares and other types of communities that the legislature is drawing here and in Chapter 116.
I understand your question, Your Honor, and that wasn't a question on which the district court, which was presented to or briefed for the district court. The issue that the district court decided on was simply and narrowly that the units themselves did not qualify as dwellings because the owners of those units didn't live there for a duration of time.
Well, but the district court also footnoted in her order, or his order, that it was influenced by the thought that these are really more akin to hotels or apartments and therefore commercial than a residential community.
Well,
so that's a bit in play.
Because that's correct. You could get that implication from there, because it is not like your usual. It's a master owners association that manages the units for the owners. But the owners still own their units, and the owners, that master unit association, still qualifies as a claimant under 610 because they are an owner's association which represents them, and there's no real difference between these. Now, it's true. I mean, it would be ridiculous to say it's not true. It looks a lot like a hotel. You rent a unit, you have to reserve it, and et cetera, and et cetera, and et cetera. They went through that multiple times. But there is a tremendous, a strong and important difference between these a timeshare homeowners or condominium association and a regular hotel, and that is exactly where this court drew the line in West Park, and that is ownership. These owners purchase their units. They spend a significant amount of money in purchasing these units. Usually they have to take out a mortgage to do so, and the legislature didn't make a distinction between who it wanted to protect. It wanted to protect individuals as opposed to commercial organizations when they have a unit or a home or whatever it happens to be. Individual unit is the term that they use in order to make it broader than just a home. And this unit owner who has made this major purchase in their life, if there is a construction defect, they're in the same position that any homeowner is. They're really not in a position to be able to protect themselves, and that's what Chapter 40 is all about.
If your declarations did not have in it that the group was formed pursuant to Chapter 116, but everything else was the same, and it was just a purely 119A timeshare, do you think you would come under Chapter 40?
I think that that there are different ways that it can be organized. It could be organized as a community or a commonly held hotel. If it had been organized without transfer of fee title ownership of the units themselves, and with all of the attributes that go with that, then yeah, there could be a different outcome. But that's the reason that it's organized the way it is because it is organized as a residential unit. So the title has transferred to the individual units, and the arguments about whether or not they have the character that there are characteristics that are similar to a hotel, I think is a red herring, because that's not a part of the statute. There's nothing in the statute that says there has to be a duration of time. You have to have no restrictions on your use of the property.
Well, with one possible exception, Mr. Wall, in some timeshares, the timeshare organization leases the unused units to the public at large. I don't know what the record shows here about Tahiti Village's rental of or to the public or use by unused units when the owners are not, when they vacate them or they don't use them during the weeks in play. Is there anything in the record concerning that subject? Because that kind of implicates the issue that Justice Pickering's raised about the initial paragraph of Chapter 116 and the distinction with timeshare units. It might make it more of a commercial venture.
Well, the record does indicate that units can be rented if the owner doesn't pay what they're supposed to pay so that the organization can recoup the taxes and the expenses for that unit. But they're not in the business. It's clear from the paperwork. And the CC&Rs, they don't have just units that haven't been sold or units that are not being used that are being rented to just anybody in order to make money.
So it's only in limited.
That is not allowed under the CC&Rs.
So the only renting of units is when someone's not paying their interval or their annual fee. Is that it?
Right, and they don't recover anything through that. They only recover for actual expenses to pay the taxes and the actual expenses.
What about unsold units?
They're not renting unsold units.
Okay.
And Mr. Wall, one last question on that is, do the interval owners, the fee simple interval owners, have a right to exchange their time in Tahiti Village for other timeshare projects around the world?
Well, people trade their timeshare just like you would. The contracts are separate from the ownership of the property. Now I own the property, I can trade it with somebody else.
Okay.
I can let somebody else come in and use it, and I can go and use theirs in some other city so that I can use this, and there's cooperative agreements so that people use these timeshares so that they can go to Las Vegas and New York and wherever else they want to go in the world. And that exists.
I almost hate to ask this question, but I will anyway. To Can the timeshare owner transfer their right to recover under a constructional defect claim to the time owner in Hawaii?
I don't know.
It's outside the scope of this.
I don't know.
The first argument today, I'm becoming increasingly concerned about where these claims
are. A very interesting question. But just to address very quickly.
Whole new enterprise, buy timeshares and acquire constructional defect claims.
The amicus brief raised the issue, the public policy issue, the policy is construction defect cases are exploding because of poor construction. That's a fact. That's what Chapter 40 is there to address. The public policy was to protect individuals, and that's what this would do. The amicus argues that you shouldn't expand the coverage of Chapter 40. That's a false dichotomy because it already covers it. The argument, there's not going to be an expansion of coverage here. The statute clearly covers it. I would like to reserve my last
one. I have one more question, though, so I'd ask that to the extent I take his time, you give him an extra couple minutes. I'm concerned about why we should issue a writ in this case, and I saw you in the audience when we were discussing the other cases, so I would like to hear from you. How are you harmed if we don't grant a writ?
Yes, you all know that I have long been an advocate of this court not getting involved in things that are going on in the district court and that we should not issue writs unless there really is an extraordinary reason. In this case, the extraordinary reason is the reason that's expressed in West Park. We won't be able to try this case effectively with half of the issues gone and not knowing which law to apply. So the first trial becomes a nullity, regardless of
the second one comes out. Is that all about the economic loss doctrine, essentially?
I'm sorry?
Is that all about the economic loss doctrine, essentially?
It's about the economic loss doctrine, and it's about which remedy is available, and it's about what kind of discovery is available if we have Chapter 40 issues, and it's also about the fact that this issue is out there and an important one that has not been resolved by this court. So we would have a trial that would be a waste of time.
I have one more question. If you went to verdict without us interceding, and you prevailed on liability on the other claims besides the Chapter 40 claims, would that adjudication of liability allow retrial only as to damages in the event following a direct appeal we were to reverse the determination on Chapter 40's applicability?
Probably not. I mean, there might be
you follow that question.
A preclusion issue, collateral estoppel issue, but the problem would be that the liability would not be determined under a negligence theory. It would be determined only under a contracts theory.
Okay.
We'd probably have to decide the negligence issues.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Flansburgh.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Happy New Year. Frank Flansburgh on behalf of respondents Martin Harris Construction and Quality Mechanical Contractors. May it please the court. Whether you apply the plain language or resort to rules of statutory interpretation, the result is the same. A timeshare is not a residence because you can't live in it. The plain language of the statute is any dwelling in which title to the individual units is transferred to the owners. I view that as two elements, at least for this case. Specifically, let's take the second part first. Title to the individual units. In this case, the title to the individual units is not transferred to the owner. Take a look at the deed. It's 554-601. It references a fractional interest, a 1/52nd interest, a 1/104th interest, or 1/156th interest, I believe it is. So it's a fractional interest. Not title to the individual unit, it's title to a fractional interest.
Oh, but what if you had a deed to a house and you had five buyers and it were fractional to them and you had the same deed? Why wouldn't that be transferred title to a residence?
Well, that's a very good point, and two points to that. One is when you have a deed to five tenants in common, for example, or joint tenants, that's conveying title to the individual unit to five persons on that deed. This deed, take a look, 554, is title to a fractional interest to one party that can hold as joint tenants.
So Mr. Flansburgh, again, you're saying the deed, and we'll look at it. It doesn't describe a unit in the deed, like a 1/52nd interest in unit 101 and an undivided interest in the whole common area. You said it's the deed describes just the whole project without referencing a unit number. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. I don't want to mislead you, Your Honor. It identifies a unit number. My point is it also identifies an interval number, a vacation plan number, and a season in which you can use it. It's conveying a fractional interest in a unit, not title to the individual unit. Unlike, as Justice Pickering brought up, where you have a title to a home, for example, that's conveyed to joint tenants or tenants in common, they have title to the individual unit. Whereas these owners, 554, I think, is the Loftus deed. In that deed, it's a title to a fractional interest, not to the individual unit. And I think there's a distinction there when you apply the plain language. Does that address your question, Justice Pickering?
To some extent. The deeds are made, though, to look as if they're transferring full title to a fractional interest in the project. And you have the recitation that it's a Chapter 116 entity, or it's coming in under that. So it's problematic. Because analytically, I'm not sure what the difference is between, is it that it's temporal that is your problem with that, that it doesn't qualify as transfer of title?
No, it's not temporal, Your Honor, because we can talk about the duration with respect to Fair Housing Act cases and things like that when we talk about dwelling. But let's stay on this deed. Covenant 5 of that deed, it's on page 556 or 604. The Covenant 5 of that restricts your fee ownership or your quiet enjoyment to the entire vacation plan. So at page 339 of the record, what you'll see there is that your use is restricted to a transient or vacation use with respect to this unit. And actually, and this I think addresses your question to Petitioner, Your Honor, is that 339 invokes Chapter 119A. And I think that's the point, Your Honor, if that more better addresses your question.
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. In addition, beyond title to the individual units, there's a second part of that statute that I think is critical here. And this makes reference to my opening remark that you can't live in a timeshare. And that is dwelling. What is a dwelling? Dwelling is not defined specifically by the statute here. The petitioner has pointed to Chapter 116 for the definition of dwelling. I believe it's 116.083. The problem with that is dwelling is part of the definition there. It's not actually being defined. However, this court has looked at the plain meaning of dwelling before in N. Ray Nielsen when you dealt with the homestead exemption. When you dealt with the homestead exemption, which applied to property on which there was a structure used as a dwelling, this court paid notice to the fact that the legislature had not defined dwelling. So this court, as footnoted in footnote 2, looked at Black's Law Dictionary, page 582, to refer to what was a dwelling or dwelling house. And what that says in Black's Law Dictionary is any house or structure in which a person lives, your residence, your abode. A timeshare is not something in which you can live. And it's certainly not your residence.
How often do we define how long you have to live to get the definition of live?
Very good point, Your Honor. And you, this is what brought up in the Fair Housing Act cases. So moving a little bit beyond the plain language, looking to rules of interpretation to courts of, that have considered similar issues, the Fair Housing Act cases, you have Hughes Memorial, U.S. v. Hughes Memorial, it's a West Virginia case. You have the 11th Circuit case of Schwartz v. Treasure Island. In both of those cases, what they looked to for dwelling was a sense of permanency, a sense of I live here, whether it's for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or several months. Do you live here? Do you cook? Do you clean? Do you go to work? Do you come home here? Because those dealt with halfway houses, children's homes, things like that.
So if you're a retiree and you don't work, you can't live someplace?
Not quite, Your Honor.
But what about opposing counsel's example in his brief of, like, I buy a home in Squaw Valley to go skiing, and I certainly don't live there, but I don't want anyone else there, so I go there a couple of weeks a year, and it's defective, and I want to bring a lawsuit.
And you
can put it over the line into Nevada. But
It's good.
It's not moving, but Mount Rose.
And you can, because there's a difference. And the best example of this is referenced in the O'Connor case, the Michigan Supreme Court case, 1999 case. In the O'Connor case, they go through that very deviation or distinction because you have you dealt there with a timeshare developer that wanted to develop in a residentially restricted area that has zoning restriction of residential use. Now, in that area, they had vacation homes. And what the court said is it did its analysis and said, well, there's a difference. There's a sense of permanency to a vacation home that's yours versus a timeshare that involves transiency. And that's really the two distinctions here. With a vacation home, you store your skis there, Your Honor, particularly if you want to go skiing in Mount Rose. You can store your golf clubs, and you can rearrange the furniture. You can paint the walls if you want. It's your vacation home. There's a sense of permanency and intent to return. Whereas when you deal with a timeshare, it's transient. You can't store your things there. You can't store your belongings there. You may not ever come back to that unit. You can request it 45 days in advance, but you may not get it. And certainly if you do get it, you don't get to change out the furniture or paint the walls. Okay? There's a difference between the permanency and transiency. And the thing, when you look at the use of this, and I may mention this because I think it's important, 339 of the record, the use that's restricted for this is a vacation transiency use. And that falls right in line with the distinction that the courts have made when you look at this. And that was the reasoning that was adopted by the district court, and I think the most persuasive one. But let's also look at the spirit of the law. And a lot was made about the opening arguments about, well, it doesn't say homes and it doesn't say homeowners. That's fair. I don't disagree with that. But what we're talking about there is when we resort to other rules of interpretation is the spirit of the law. You've done that in Nancy. You've done that in West Park. What's the spirit of the law? The spirit of the law is that homeowners should have their homes fixed. So that homeowner doesn't have to come home and live under the roof every day with a defective home so that they have an expeditious way of getting that home repaired. We're dealing with timeshare owners who have a home most likely somewhere else that they go to every day, and they should have those homes fixed. But the timeshare, they're there for 1 week out of a year, maybe 1 week out of 2 years or 3 years, depending on which plan they purchase.
And my understanding also is that they're not guaranteed any particular time in the unit they own.
That's exactly right. In fact, Your Honor, you have to request a unit 45 days in advance. And when you make that request, you have to give them alternatives. You may never, ever stay in the unit that is identified on the deed. And that's because it's subject under Covenant 5 to the vacation plan. I mean, you don't necessarily get that.
Who pays the real property taxes on this? There was some mention in the record in the briefs about you were looking at the assessor's rolls and they were looking at the deeds, and therefore there was some disconnect in the initial motion practice. Is it the case that the assessor doesn't tax the people who get the deeds to these units, rather they tax the association or somebody else?
That's correct. And when you look at the APN online, all you see is the declarant, Soleil.
All you see is what?
The Soleil. Soleil is the owner, the association, okay. The declarant. And you'll see those in the record. And the reason for that is because they do pay the taxes. Now, to be fair, there's provisions in the CC&Rs that those taxes should be passed on as part of the assessments that are billed, but it's not the individual fractional interest owner that pays the taxes directly to the county or anyone else. Does that address your question, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm. Do you have any illumination to add on why Chapter 116 carves out timeshares with certain exceptions, one of them being you can adopt that the HOA will be governed by 116 and the timeshare?
I think largely because of the issues that we're struggling with today, Your Honor, that timeshares, when you're dealing with fractional interest, you're dealing with 52 potential owners, 104, 156 of one individual unit, it creates complications that are beyond 116. That would be my assessment, Your Honor.
Mr. Feinzer, was that issue brought up before Judge Johnson on the exclusion under 116?
No, I don't believe it was. My recollection from the record is that it wasn't. But, of course, we have to look at this de novo, Your Honor. This is a statutory interpretation of what constitutes a dwelling entitled to the individual units. So under that de novo review, I think it's something we can appropriately consider.
But if you're going to draft an opinion, you'd have to address it. I mean, that's one of the problems with writ review.
Yes, and I thought a lot about this, and not to necessarily predict your next question of whether it's appropriate for writ relief.
It's fair prediction.
I've struggled with this when I've been sitting in the audience, quite honestly, because I think the fundamental problem from both of us is the economic loss doctrine, because you run into an Olson-Terracon dilemma. Right, it applies in the commercial context, but not in the residential context, and that makes it very difficult to proceed forward to finality of a resolution in the case.
So you two would like us to entertain and resolve this writ?
Yeah, I think so, Your Honor. To be fair, even though it should be my position that you should not entertain it as a writ, but to be fair, had the decision come out the other way, you would have seen my writ petition, and I would be sitting at the table to the right. So I think that's a fair. Our response. Another thing is we have to look at is the absurdity of some results, right? Because consider this for a moment. When you have individual homeowners, it gets to be daunting enough when you have large subdivisions, right? You've got lots of homeowners that can accept repairs, reject settlements, direct litigation, things of that nature. The ranging of this effect is, who gets to decide? You have 52 owners at a minimum of one unit that have never met each other, most likely, that have no relationship with one another. Maybe 104, maybe 156. You extrapolate that over just this one timeshare complex, and you're talking about 80,000 owners directing this. But if you look at the individual unit itself, which we still won't see where the entire 52 fractional interests have been sold. Is that a majority vote? Is that a supermajority vote? How do we resolve that? In the end, I come to a very practical conclusion. And that is, if this is a residence, a dwelling, something in which we live according to the plain meaning as adopted in Ray Nelson, we can't go there today. If we wanted to go to the unit that's identified in one of the deeds at 554-601, we can't go there today. You'd have to make a request 45 days in advance. As Justice Perigary pointed out, even if we requested it, we may not get it because we have to give alternatives. But let's say we did that, and let's say we got our unit that's shown on the deed. Can we go right now? No. It's 12:10. Check-in time is at 4 o'clock. So we got to wait till 4 o'clock to go to this dwelling. Then, if we get there, can we just go upstairs and put our key in the door and unlock it and go in? No. You've got to check in with the desk, drop off your credit card for incidentals, and get a hotel room key. Those are not the indications of a dwelling in some place we live, whether temporarily, Justice Douglas, or permanently. It doesn't have the same sense of permanency that a condo or home does. Unless there are questions, Your Honors?
Well, along with your argument, it reminds me of the residents in terms of when you say you're a resident of Nevada or California or things of that nature, is that for an indefinite period of time? Do you have to have, I'm here, I've put my toe over the line, intend to be here for 120 days or 10 days or whatever? I don't see those kind of constraints in the statute. And I, as much as I appreciate the use of the word homeowner, it really comes down to owner. And owner of a dwelling or owner of a residence. And it doesn't really get into some of the things that you are putting forth. For the period of time, as you said, you're allowed to go there, and the document you were referencing on 554 talks about fee simple absolute. That period of time, however limited it is. So I still have that query. I understand your concerns, and this is a very interesting issue, but trying to look back at the statute and depending on the side of the argument and who's making it, the limitations or expansiveness as to what we read in that statute.
If it pleases the court, may I take 1 minute to address?
Chief?
Well, I didn't hear a question. I heard a comment. So I think we'll just end it right here, Mr. Flansburgh. I appreciate your point. Mr. Wall, you'll have
thank
a
you very
minute
much for
to wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can live in my, while I'm there in my timeshare condominium, I can live in a hotel. Some people live in hotels long term. The statute says any dwelling. And title. Those are the two issues. The judge, district judge, accepted that title had passed. In fact, they hadn't even raised the issue of title.
Wait, so a hotel room qualifies too?
No, a hotel room wouldn't qualify because no title. There's two parts, dwelling and title. I can dwell in a hotel, but I don't have title. That's the difference. And that's originally in their briefs, they want the plain language of the statute. Here, he's asking for you to interpret the law according to the spirit of the law, which is what they wish the law were. The statute is plain.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Mr. Flansburgh, thank you very much for your arguments and briefs. Well done. We really appreciate the input, and the matter will stand submitted.